Start again.
And does this go on and on, or is it voice activated?
It's fine. All you have to do is talk.
Okay. And it's the Mountain Monastery of the San Francisco Zen Center. And I went down there to do what's called Dharma Transmission Ceremony, which is to receive... what is it? It's kind of a... well, you're receiving what's called receiving transmission. It's called transmission. It involves receiving some kind of empowerment or authorization or recognition or acknowledgement in a very intimate, personal way between two people, between one of the abbots of the Zen Center and myself. And it was a very involved, in some ways, 10 days. I'm kind of tired from it. I came back yesterday. In some ways, it was very much like a retreat. It was we were kind of pretty much busy the whole time with all kinds of activities. And for those of you who don't know, in addition to being a Vipassana teacher and grounded in the Theravadin tradition, I'm also a Zen priest, feeling myself very grounded in the Zen tradition, which raises some eyebrows. But maybe not as much. You know, there's Zen teachers who are Catholic monks and nuns. So if that's possible, certainly. And so I was ordained as a Zen priest in 1982. And San Francisco Zen Center for about 20 years. I've come and gone somewhat from there. Sometimes I've thought of myself a little bit as kind of a black sheep of the family up there because of the coming and going that I've done. But about 5 years ago, I started this process of preparing for this next level, this stage called Dharma Transmission. And what it recognizes or empowers a person to be is an independent Zen teacher. And you kind of can, well, you're independent. You can teach without any... You can be responsible for making your own decisions about how to teach and what to teach. And you can lead sesshins. You could do ordinations. I can now ordain someone as a Zen priest or a Zen monk. I heard rumors that one of the reasons the abbot wanted to ordain me, give me this transmission, I don't know if this is true, it's a rumor. Someone else's maybe speculation. But was that since I had gotten this recognition to be a teacher in this tradition, they wanted to hurry up and balance it out. So I don't know if that's true or not. Part of the ceremony, or these 10 days, a lot of it was recognizing the lineage of people who have brought face-to-face, brought personal relationships from Shakyamuni Buddha down to the present, who brought it to me through my teacher. And I am supposed to be, I think, the 92nd generation from the historical Buddha. And there's 91 people between me and the Buddha. And sometimes we have about 91 people in this room. So it's not so many people, you know, in direct lineage, direct line back. And some of, in the Zen tradition, however, if you go before the first 1,000 years, and lineage is 2,500 years old, the first 1,000 years is kind of mythological in the sense that it's somewhat made up. They just kind of needed to find, the Chinese kind of needed to find some direct lineage back to the Buddha, so they chose some of the great illustrious Indian teachers to to put in their lineage. But regardless of which part is mythological, which part is, the fact that it's an actual living tradition of individuals, empowering individuals, that goes back at least 1,500 years, 1,400 years, I think is quite phenomenal. So in a sense, in Tibetan Buddhism, they talk about becoming a lineage holder. And I never heard that language used in Zen, but I think that's in some ways accurate, because now I'm a holder of lineage and I'm empowered to continue past the lineage on. And in some ways, I feel it comes with, for me, a sense of responsibility to lineage then. I'm the caretaker of lineage, and hopefully in some responsible way I can pass it on. If someone has received Dharma transmission, they fulfill their duty or obligation or whatever, if they're able to pass it on at least to one other person. So we'll see if that happens or not. So part of the ceremony is each day, from either one or three times a day, making the rounds around the monastery and bowing at each altar, each of the main altars. And there's many altars in the monastery. And usually we did this at 4:30 in the morning before everybody else woke. Walk around in the dark with a flashlight, and it's quite beautiful to do this. Sometimes we did it after everyone went to sleep. It's also quite nice. And there was a new moon during this time. There's a lot of stars. And the second day in which we went around, so we bow at the main altar in the meditation hall. We bowed. They set up some extra altars in the meditation hall for us to bow at. And we bowed at the founder's hall, and Suzuki Roshi is the founder of Zen Center, and there's a special altar for him, and we went there and bowed. We bowed to the abbot's cabin, to the abbot, and we bow at the altar at the bathroom, the altar in the study hall, the altar in the kitchen, in the baths, the altar, again, at the, kind of an altar that faces the grave site where the ashes of Suzuki Roshi are. And then there's an altar at the gatehouse, kind of the entrance to the monastery. And then finally you go back and you bow at the main altar again to the Bodhisattva of wisdom, Manjushri, some of you might know. And then finally you go out if you've been to Tassajara, if you go out of the meditation hall, there's a kind of like a porch, a walkway around the whole building. And you stand there looking out down onto the compound of the monastery, and you do a bow to the whole monastery. And at which point you bow and you say, for the protection and safety of the practitioners and the practice of this monastery. And the second day I did this, I went around to all these places that were quite familiar to me, because I've been a monk at that monastery for about 3 years of my life. And a lot of those places, a lot of where there's altars, had entered into my body in some way. That I'd practiced there, I'd lived there, in those places. And those places partly had become me. And probably partly those places, I had become those places. But certainly I had incorporated into my body. And a lot of what Zen practice is a bodily practice. Sometimes people are involved in Buddhism, they think it's kind of intellectual or cognitive and kind of a head trip. But it's very much a bodily practice. And Zen stresses this more than probably... was one of the Buddhist traditions that stresses it a lot. And if you go through, feel your body being changed by the very training itself. So part of my body is the training that I got in various Zen monasteries I practiced in. So when I came around to these places, which I recognized, that there was a resonance within me with these places, it became for me a bowing of gratitude and appreciation for these places, for the practice. So I told this to one of the people who was helping with the ceremony, and she said, actually what you're doing when you're going around bowing at all the altars is you're protecting the monastery. Being a kind of a field of protection, of safety or something. for everybody's practice there. And so I thought that that was great, because I want to protect the practice and the practitioners. And maybe the best way to protect a practice is to have gratitude for it, and gratitude and appreciation. And we spent a lot of time honoring the lineage. Each day you went to the meditation hall, and we had to do one bow to the floor. We had to offer incense, chant the name, hit a big bell, and do a full prostration for each ancestor. And the first day, we had the bowing wrong a little bit, and we went up and down an extra time each time. And by the end of the day, my knees hurt. It was a difficult ceremony for my knees, these 10 days. You spend a lot of time, you know, in Seiza, you sit on your knees. People go practice Zen in Japan, and it's hard enough to sit cross-legged for a lot of people. But what really makes it sometimes impossible for people to practice Zen in Japan in Zen monasteries, in Zen monasteries, they sit a lot on their knees also. Not in meditation, but there's a lot of other times when you do that. And sitting on your knees is kind of sometimes the hardest for Western knees. People are not used to it. It was a very intense 10 days. You know, some of you have been, just being there in itself is kind of a rarefied environment, kind of intense and very different from the rest of your normal life. And people who go there for a while and leave often find some dissonance with coming back out because of the difference. But we were kind of there were five of us, two people receiving transmission, and the abbot and two helpers. And there was five of us with a kind of who were kind of this compound within the monastery. We had our own little place, and we were our own little group. We ate together usually, and spent a lot of time together, and kind of oblivious of the rest of the monastery, kind of ignoring it in many ways. So it's 10 very days doing these various ceremonies, and the second to last day, there's two parts to the transmission ceremony. One part is receiving, it's called Denkai, which is receiving the transmission of the precepts. And in Buddhism, we take the precepts a lot. And usually, formally take them, you take it from a monk or a teacher. But in Zen, you can still do that, but the formal ceremony, kind of in Theravada Buddhism, they don't have really a formal ceremony of commitment. Becoming a Buddhist, or really committing yourself to the precepts and aligning your life according to Buddhist values, at least according to the Buddhist precepts. But in Zen, they have very formal rituals of commitment where you're going to now align your life with the precepts. And in order to do this, one way of understanding it is that one way to really make it formal really have a serious commitment involved in the ceremony, there is a certain empowerment given from the person who gives the precepts has a certain empowerment to do so. And that empowerment then adds a certain gravity to the precept ceremony itself. So the ceremony then was one night, was after everyone had gone to sleep, kind of private or secret, was to receive the precepts, be empowered with the precepts. And then the second night, at midnight, was the actual transmission of the Dharma itself. And there were various esoteric... What surprised me about the ceremony is that how much of what we commonly think is part of other Buddhist traditions is found in this ceremony. And if you spend a lot of time with Zen, you see that Zen, almost all other schools of Buddhism, even though if you kind of, you know, if you go to, I don't know, if you go to Kanondo here in Mountain View, it's pretty, you know, it's a community meditation center, and it's relatively pared down and simple and straightforward. But if you kind of get deeply into the whole tradition, the way it's done in a more formal setting, you find all of Buddhism kind of in its corners. And some of it was found there, some of the more esoteric forms of Buddhism. Esoteric forms of Buddhism is Tantric Buddhism, what we know nowadays mostly as Tibetan Buddhism. And Tibetan, what we call Tibetan Buddhism, the Tantric forms of Buddhism, not only was transmitted to China, to Tibet, but was also transmitted to China, and from there to Japan. And the Zen tradition has within it Tantric transmissions. And part of this is the empowerments, and part of this comes out, or the only place I know of it where it really exists is in this transmission ceremony.
What makes Tibetan Zen different?
The way let's see, how does it make a difference? Zen, I don't know, just it's many things, but Zen is in some ways very much like Tantric Buddhism. There's different parts to Tibetan Buddhism. Tibetan Buddhism has many different levels, we can say. And the Tantric level, which is sometimes considered to be the highest level, is sometimes compared with Zen, because both of them are a teaching or a practice which you're supposed to be able to attain the full realization of enlightenment in one lifetime, rather than in more standard or orthodox forms of Tibet. It's a many lifetime process, and it involves a very direct seeing of the true nature of the mind or of reality, or participation in the true mind of reality. Some people feel that the Dzogchen tradition of Tibetan Buddhism is actually a transmission of Zen Buddhism into Tibetan Buddhism. And the Tibetans don't like to admit that because they don't want to admit that they got anything from China. I first started practicing Buddhism seriously by practicing Zen. And I first was introduced to it, I guess, in 1975. But I didn't really start sitting seriously until a year later, I guess 1976. And I sat then by myself in a garage where I was a college student. And I sat for various personal reasons. I wanted to kind of be a better person and have more friends, and I thought it would help. And another reason, I wasn't so happy, I guess. And what happened was, within a few months of sitting this way, I sat twice a day, 6 days a week. I took Sundays off. The various reasons I had for practicing, for going and sitting every day, stopped being operative, stopped kind of functioning, stopped being reasons anymore. And I found it very strange that even though I no longer had any reasons to meditate every day, I kept doing it anyway. And it was a person who, at least before, who needed to have reasons for everything I did. And so here I kept doing something without a reason. I thought this was very irrational. And why did I keep doing it? And after some time, what I realized was that through my meditation practice, I was able to express that the meditation practice was the deepest form of self-expression that I had. And I didn't sit in order to get calm, or I didn't sit in order to have insights, I didn't sit in order to get anything, except to sit. They say in Zen, you sit in order just to sit. But another way perhaps of saying that, you sit in order to really express yourself. And that's maybe a side that you don't really understand in Vipassana practice until you've done a lot. You realize that even mindfulness practice, when your practice matures, is probably the deepest form of self-expression that you can that exists for a person. The dualism of this being a technique in order to get something falls away, and the idea that you're the doer and you're doing your body or your mind, you're doing something to it. You know, controlling your breath or following your breath or settling your mind or doing whatever. All that falls away, and it becomes a powerful act of participation in the universe, participation in just presence, which I understand as being kind of a self-expression. And then from that feeling, and this is the deepest form of self-expression I had, like an artist might feel that their self-expression is painting or sculpting or whatever, I became very interested in finding how I could integrate this sense of integrity that I felt within me in meditation into my daily life. And so I tried to kind of explore ways of doing that in my college community among my friends and housemates. But I found it actually very difficult because they had no sense of another way of living, another possibility, another possible way of living in the world. And the ego trips that I had, that people have, you know, we tend to support each other in it. And so sometimes our friends and families are the best supports. And so I found that it was very difficult to begin exploring or finding a way of coming into my ordinary life out of meditation with the same integrity that I felt in meditation. But I felt very impassioned. This is what I wanted to do. It didn't feel right to live superficially in my daily life when I could live so deeply in my meditation. And that's when I decided to go find a community to practice with, because I felt that there's a practice community that understands some of these things and can support my experiments, my practice. And that's when I moved to the San Francisco Zen Center. And as I practiced the Zen Center, this desire to integrate more of my life with this deep sense of integrity that came from meditation became more and more of a driving force for me. And it wasn't so much that I wanted to go deeper in meditation. Certainly I could have gone deeper in meditation, but that wasn't really an issue for me. I felt some real deep at-homeness in sitting. And I wanted to have that at-homeness in all my activities. So I took various steps in the San Francisco Zen Center. Each step that I took, kind of getting more involved, were actually attempts to try to penetrate more of my life with the integrity or the self-expression that came from my meditation. And so first I lived in San Francisco near the Zen Center, and then I moved to Green Gulch, their farm in Marin. And from there I moved to the monastery. And after some time in the monastery, I was ordained as a priest. And after some time as a priest, I went to Japan to practice the monasteries in Japan. So kind of, I just felt in some ways like water going downhill. I just kind of was what seemed just the right thing to do. And in my time, my 3 years I spent at Tassajara, I understood Zen practice to be two things. One is I felt the life of Tassajara, was a lifestyle itself. It wasn't a practice in the sense that it was the practice to get somewhere or do something or attain something, understand anything. But it sounds a little strange to say this now, but it seemed like even though we got up at 4 o'clock in the morning and followed this monastic schedule, it felt very much for me like an ideal lifestyle where you could just fully participate in this deeper form of self-expression in all the activities of your life. And I couldn't think of anything more wonderful in a life than doing that. And the opportunity in, I think, any spiritual practice is to make it part of your whole life. And as Thomas Merton said, a spiritual life is first of all a life. And we tend to compartmentalize so much in our society. And for some of you, some of us, that's going to be fine to do that. People simply enjoy and appreciate this practice because it allows them to relax and de-stress. Some people, it gives them more physical stamina or strength, improves the immunity system. There's a lot of benefits, you know, so-called benefits from this practice. You know, a lot of people want to improve the quality of their life, and so they come here to improve the quality of their life. But the kind of messages we get from our society about the improvement of the quality of our life, I mean, what are those things? We want to have, you know, be physically stronger. We want to be young forever. We want a better sex life. You know, what are the kind of various qualities of life that people are running after? And there's nothing wrong with that necessarily. But if that's the ultimate value that someone has for their life, they're asking for big time trouble. Because most of these qualities that people chase after are short-term at best, and they're very fragile. Who knows, you know, what's going to happen with your health. And when I understand spiritual life as being a whole life, it's not about necessarily improving the quality of your life in the normal kind of consumer ways in which our society has. But it doesn't have to do with what happens to us in our life, but rather has to do with how we live our life, how we engage ourselves with our life. A level of what Buddhism calls unconditioned awareness, a level of participation and awareness of our life, which is not conditioned or influenced or reacting to all the conditions around and within us. So if your health becomes weak, can you still have a balanced mind? If you get famous, or if you become obscure, if you get wealthy, you become poor, if you're employed or unemployed, if you have a spouse or a partner or not, the unconditioned awareness and freedom that's possible isn't dependent on those things. Some way of living that doesn't swing back and forth between those kind of dualities, those kind of polarities that most of us are swinging through back and forth all the time. And I saw, you know, I still have it for sure. I saw it, you know, here I was getting empowered, you know, to be this Zen teacher, you know. And part of the ceremony was to draw, you're given these long, you have to copy out your own documents of succession. And there are three, in calligraphy, in Japanese, kind of in brush strokes, in brushing. And you're given the silk cloth or silk fabric that's about 7 foot long and about this wide. And you have to use this red and black ink. And it's not like you can erase it. I've never really done any brushwork at all. I did one afternoon of some practice beforehand, and you have to make these very straight lines and straight, you know, like nice circles like they have in Zen, and you know, and my circles kind of look like eggs and So I tried to do my best I could, and I could see in my mind, I could feel, you know, that I was concerned about the artistic quality of my work. And, you know, the Zen master, he would come, you know, look at me. And, you know, and so what I tried to do, I could see a tendency. So what I tried to do was say, well, look, I kind of gave myself a pep talk. I said, look, you're being empowered now to be a Zen teacher. You should know better. So I kind of said, okay, so that's what's going on a little bit. So what I'm going to do, I'm just going to put myself into this and try to do the best I can and not try to look over at Pat, who was also doing this woman who was doing it the same ceremony, and see how she's doing. And just try to stay, you know, balanced in the midst of it. And to practice, try to practice not being caught by these little self-centered concerns of mine, comparative concerns. So one part of Zen practice is this ideal lifestyle, just living your life and living it fully without the kind of egotistical concerns or self-centered concerns, comparative concerns, but really being yourself completely. And I think the ideal in Buddhism is not to become someone extraordinary, you know, to have all this halo and all this wonderful stuff, but rather to just become an ordinary person. To really become who you are in your own uniqueness and be at home in that and feel content in that. And that, I think, is one of the best gifts we can give other people. If we're trying to become someone great or someone wonderful or famous or rich or whatever, it usually comes out of a sense of inadequacy or a sense of lack of self-worth or a sense of grasping or craving or something of non-acceptance. And if we have that, I think it tends to resonate with that in that very thing in the people around us. And we support each other as a society in doing all these things. And if you can really be yourself and just be an ordinary person as you are, I think it's a great gift to society. And even though, when I first came to San Francisco Zen Center, the first priest I met was Ed Brown. And I was really gung-ho in Zen practice. And Ed Brown is a little bit kind of, I don't know if some of you might know him. And I thought the idea in Zen practice was to become like Ed Brown. And a daunting task. That's what I thought. You know, he's the first Zen priest I met. And I thought, well, that's the result of Zen practice, is to be like Ed Brown. And then I started meeting all these, and they were so different from Ed Brown. And I quickly learned that it wasn't to be Ed Brown, it was to be yourself. And it takes many forms. So one part of Zen practice is just, it's a lifestyle, just a living, just living your life, leaving yourself alone to be ordinary and really participating in your life. Having enough trust to do that. And I think a lot of Buddhist practice is a practice of trust, just to live your life in a straightforward way. The other part of the monastic practice or Buddhist practice is practice, what we call maybe practice itself, is being engaged in a certain practice of mind, following the breath or loving kindness or compassion. And there's many ways of talking about this, but following up where I just talked about trust, I think there's two parts to the Buddhist practice or Zen practice, and the part that's being, it's a training. And it's a training, it's two things. It's one is to discover what your deepest trust is in life, or what your deepest expression, your deepest self-expression is, your deepest intention for your life, your heart's deepest wish. To discover what that is, to get out of your own way, to let that kind of rise. And that's, just to do that, I think, is a powerful spiritual practice. And a lot of people, when they come to spirituality, this is what they're looking for, is to understand what their deepest expression is. And what's sad is how often people will take the expression or the idea or whatever that the tradition gives them as being the purpose of the practice, the purpose of their life. And they're incorporating something which is not their own. And people would spend decades kind of with, you know, trying to be a good Buddhist or trying to be a good Christian or good Jew or whatever, internalizing some external authority. But from a Buddhist perspective, it has to come from yourself at some point. So discovering what that is. The other part then, if you can't discover what that is to discover what keeps you from discovering that level of trust. What's keeping you from trusting your life in a deep way? And those two are very important aspects of Buddhist practice. Discovering what the deepest thing you can trust, which maybe is the same thing as saying your deepest intention for your life. What that is, or discovering what gets in the way. The fears, the anxieties, the guilts, the cravings, the doubts. There's all these things that come up that cover those things. And if you can discover your deepest expression, then that deepest expression is something which is, it can be said is a responsiveness to life, rather than what we often say is a reactivity to life. Because when you discover your deepest intention, you discover that who you are is interpenetrating with everyone else, with the rest of reality. Then you discover your deepest intention. Your deepest intention is not a self-centered intention, but your own deepest intention is the intention of the universe, the intention of the world, the intention of the situation. And it's very personal. So you don't have to worry about losing your personality, losing yourself. But it's also very impersonal. It's both. And from that place, we can respond rather than react to the world. Respond to what the given situation is. And a life of a Buddhist, I think, at some point, is learning to respond. And so, after my first year in the monastery at Tassajara, I spent a lot of time wondering, you know, what I should do with my life. because you know, you're supposed to wonder about such things and figure something out. And I spent a lot of time thinking about my motivations for the various things I could think of doing, and feeling in some ways mistrustful of my motivations. I spent a lot of time just reflecting, thinking about them, purifying them, going deeper into them. And one of the options that I felt I had was to throw myself entirely into the world of Buddhism, which for me at that time was all I knew was Zen. Throw myself into Zen, Zen practice. And I remember one afternoon where something had happened that made me kind of, I went and sat by the river at Tassajara and to really think seriously about what I should do. And in the midst of this, somehow the intensity or the pointedness in which that I engaged myself in this query, this investigation, this inquiry, produced a change in my body. My body shifted at some point. And out of my body, I knew what I had to do. And I decided, I knew the right thing for me to do was to become ordained as a Zen monk or Zen priest. And the next moment, what the words that came to mind was, the idea that came to mind, was that there was all this suffering in the world. And I wanted to find a way of responding to the suffering of the world at its roots. That it's great to respond at suffering at various levels in which humans experience suffering. But what I wanted to do with my life was try to engage suffering in myself and in the world, which is usually in Buddhism is considered to be self-clinging or self-identification or a strong attachment to self. And I didn't know whether I'd be effective in the world with this decision, but that's the response to the suffering, the response to the world that somehow came out of my body. And when so about a year later I was then ordained as a Zen priest, I felt very much that what it was a public statement or public commitment on my part, a public showing or acknowledgement that this is the direction I was going to take my life. And there's a culture in America for someone doing something like that with their whole life, but that's the path I chose. And since that time, since that was in 1982, Buddhism, Buddhist practice, and supporting other people to practice has been my whole life. And I feel very, very fortunate that it's worked, that somehow our culture has made it possible, that somehow the opportunities have opened up to me. And part of the Zen tradition, actually isn't just a Zen tradition, one of the paths that exists for Buddhists, paths that a Buddhist practitioner can follow. And one of the paths is the path of the Bodhisattva. And people falsely think that the Bodhisattva path belongs to only the Mahayana Buddhism. And Theravadan Buddhism of Southeast Asia doesn't have the Bodhisattva path, but only the Arhat path. And this is not true. That the Bodhisattva path exists equally in both traditions. And it's a pan-Buddhist event. And that for me, when I was ordained as a Zen priest, and how I still feel is that I'm on a bodhisattva path. A path, partly of, very much a path of service to other people. And as I continued my Buddhist practice, I ended up through various unusual twists of fate, through partly thanks to Japanese airlines and partly thanks to the Japanese consul embassy in Bangkok, being introduced to Vipassana. and that's another story for another day. But I feel for me that Buddhism is a whole rather than, you know, separate religions within it. And my dedication is to Buddhism and not to Vipassana or to Zen. But make the different skillful means in their own time and place. And I'll end with a quote from a Zen poem that says, all things have their function. It's a matter of use in the appropriate situation. So it would have been nice to have had some questions to give you a chance to respond and ask whatever seemed important for you to ask. But it's already over time, and maybe next week we can have a little bit of time for questions like that. Thank you.